I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Sarit Thacker.
I'm Itamar Srulovich. Together we run a couple of Middle Eastern restaurants in London.
And we also do our fair share of food writing.
You're listening to Honey & Co., where we take turns interviewing interesting people from the world of food in front of a small audience at our deli, Honey & Spice.
In this series, we'll be meeting producers and makers who create some of the essential ingredients in cooking.
The people you're going to hear from supply us, inspire us, improve our cooking and our life in general.
We hope you enjoy and have fun geeking out with us about all things food.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
This is the last in this series where we've been chatting to makers, growers and producers. We saved one special guest until last. Tonight we have Guy Singh Watson of Riverford Organic joining us. We talked a lot about worms and aphids. We talked about earth and we talked about pesticides and supermarkets. It was a really interesting evening, and if anyone that gets the boxes knows about Guy's rants, you're in for a treat. We have plenty of those. Hope you enjoy the listening.
You know, in this series, we're kind of looking into the building blocks of what we eat. You know, we talked about olive oil and butter and bread and really kind of the elements of what we cook and what we eat. And I think most of what we eat, and as a species, what we've been eating throughout our existence is about vegetables. We are more than proud, more than honored to have Mr. Vegetables. You've been called that before?
No, I haven't. No, yeah. That's a first.
That's a first, and that's recorded, so there you go. Guy Singh Watson from Riverford Farm. I'm sure everybody here heard about this guy, needs really no introduction. I think that now more than ever, it's important for us to talk about vegetables, how they're grown, how they've sold, how they get to us, what we do with them. And I am beyond pleased to have, I think, the biggest authority on all of these subjects here with us. Please, a big welcome to Guy Singh Watson.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into farming and how you became a farmer.
Oh, well, my parents were both farmers, but I guess my mum was maybe more of a cook than a farmer. And it was just, you know, from when I could walk, I think it was always kind of inevitable. That was what I was going to do. I did try and escape destiny a couple of times, but I was always drawn back to the farm, and I just feel really privileged to have found my thing, I suppose.
Yeah,
I
mean, found it where you were born.
Yeah, and you know, I had to go and look at other things, but really there was never much doubt that that was what I was going to do. And I did try, my dad gave me a pig when I was 8, who went on to have many piglets, 14 every time, twice a year.
That's a lot of pigs.
That was a lot of pigs. Yeah. And then I kept sheep and milk cows, and to be honest, it wasn't really until I started growing vegetables that I found my...
Your calling.
My calling, really, yeah, yeah. I'm rather ashamed to say that as a young man I had a pretty foul temper, and you know, that's not a good thing around animals, so
Wouldn't the vegetables take it a little bit more quietly?
I think the vegetables, probably they force you to kind of introspect a little bit. You can't blame it on anyone else. You know, deal with it. You know, find out what it is that's making you angry and sort it out, which, you know, 40 years on, I'd like to think that I have.
Well, that's progress for you. That is growth. You've kind of brought a lot of different ideas into farming at a time where farming was in a massive change. I think, you know, for the longest time in human history, that, you know, we were farming a certain way, and that we had a certain connection to our vegetables and to the people who grew them. And I think in this kind of century, things started to change and grow and go in very strange directions. And you kind of radicalized the whole idea.
Yeah,
you started with organic farming in
86. I sowed my first leeks. But it was, I mean, it was, I think my father was very influential. And, you know, he started farming after the war, 1951. There was still food rationing. It was all about producing more or less, whatever the cost. And, you know, that involved increasing amounts of fertilizer and pesticides. And I guess by the time I was, you know, a teenager, he was starting to get disillusioned with that. And I think that probably, I can remember walking across certain fields with him and him explaining to me, you know, why the crop had failed, that, you know, the soil was exhausted, that it couldn't take this intensity of cropping. And I think that did kind of all, you know, sink in. And then when I did go to university and start studying the soil and ecology and so on, and maybe it all added up. And you know, when I came back to the farm, you know, that's when my brother had just come out of hospital with paraquat poisoning, so that was quite influential. You know, just these chemicals that I was using routinely as a teenager with you know, skulls and crossbones all over them, and I was incredibly negligent. I mean, you know, I hope it doesn't come to catch up on me, you know, because, you know, I was regularly spraying the barley and, you know, drenched in these bloody pesticides. I can remember drenching sheep, you know, and you wore oil skins and it got hot by the end of the day and everyone took them off. And, you know, you were drenched in
poison.
In poisons, really? Yeah, these were nerve poisons. That's what you were dipping the sheep in. And you know, and a lot of farmers did get sick from it. So, you know, I think we were all incredibly negligent, and, you know, hope I got away with it.
But still in 86, it was not, you know, the whole idea of organic farming, certainly on a bigger scale, was not really something that we thought about,
yeah,
that people thought about. You know, other than, you know, well, I think organic food, even, you know, when I was in my teens, was very much, you know, the hippie kind of margin. It was not,
yeah,
mainstream at all.
I suppose I'm probably second generation. There were a whole load of people in the 60s who ran away. They all went west. You know, they went to Pembrokeshire or Devon or Cornwall or the Hebrides or something, you know, and they all, you know, to get away and start this new idyllic life, which involved growing food organically. So, you know, I was following in the footsteps of those people. And some of them made a real go of it. And some of them were kind of role models to me. And I did spend quite a lot of time with those people when I was, you know, floundering around trying to learn what I was doing. So it didn't feel as radical as it probably would have been if I hadn't grown up, if I'd grown up somewhere else. They call it the Golden Triangle. TQ9, our postcode, as they prefer, is TQ9ers. And, you know, there were a lot of sandals and a lot of organic vegetables and, yeah, and a lot of dope, yeah.
Happy days.
Which wasn't, yeah, which was my first crop, of course.
You know that this is recorded, yeah?
I think it's probably outside the,
yeah,
statue.
Yeah. Of course, now, you know, I wouldn't touch this stuff. Coming soon to Riverford Box near you. That'll be a business model and a half. Was it accepted? I mean, we say, okay, we're going to do things radically different. We're going to take away everything that, you know, is meant to help us be successful as farmers and do without it. How did it go down in TQ9?
Well, it was funny. My first kind of thing was to go and talk to some of the older guys on the farm. There was in particular a guy called John Scott who was, you know, he must have been farming since the 40s. He was playing with a horse when my father took on the tenancy. So, you know, we're really... And I told him that I was going to grow organically, and I thought he must have some wisdom. And he did have a tremendous amount of wisdom, but he said, you know, don't think I'm going to pick up a whole bay. You know, I've had enough singling turnips. And, you know, he wanted to... for him, it was all about going backwards, which is a... and maybe it did seem like that, but I really don't think organic farming should be regarded as going back in time. You know, a lot of it is you know, learning how you're going to control the weeds, you know, without that level of hand work, which on the whole we have. And, you know, it does still go wrong sometimes, but, you know, we don't spend a lot of time on our hands and knees pulling out weeds these days. And we have found, through understanding the ecology of the crops and the their pests and their pest predators, you know, we have in most instances found ways of controlling the pests and diseases. I'm not saying it's a complete thing. You know, we still do struggle with, you know, potato blight and weeds in very early crops of carrots and so on. But yeah, mostly it's going forward rather than
going back. I've you know, we went to the farm a couple of weeks ago, and it's incredibly sophisticated and incredibly creative. You know, we've seen the little lettuce beds, and they explained to us how they manage them, that they sprout all the weeds and then they burn them and then they plant the lettuce leaves and they come back. It's really very, very sophisticated and very thought and very kind of,
as a matter of fact,
creative
that,
almost.
That is a technique, getting a stale seed bed which is centuries old. You know, either you make a very fine seed bed and you roll it and create all the conditions perfect for weed germination. In fact, sometimes we'll even cover it with the fleeces, which keep the moisture in, and it gets really warm under there, and all the seeds, well, 95% of the seeds in the top couple of inches will germinate, and then you kill them either by a very, very shallow cultivation or through a thermal, it's just like a gas grill that you run over the top, and then you sow your crop, or sometimes you even sow the crop first and burn afterwards just before the crop comes through, and it comes through without any weeds, and you know, that, you know, it can reduce hand weeding by 95%. You know.
It's very sophisticated and very sounds very modern as well. It doesn't sound ancient at all. You had this knowledge kind of laying around you, or you had to invent as you go?
Well, I do love, as soon as everybody else, when everyone else becomes an organic farmer, I want to do something else for sure, because that's just what I love the discovery that there's no blueprint for how to do it. You have to kind of work it out yourself. But, you know, you don't want to make all the mistakes yourself. So I did spend a lot of time driving around the country, and indeed in Holland they were, you know, considerably ahead of us in some of these techniques. So I would go and visit farmers in Holland and in the east of England and just learn whatever I could from them, and then go home, experiment, observe, find out what works, review it, you know, change it a little bit, and, you know, and 35 years later, that's still what I'm doing, and I'm still learning, and I that's what I love about it, really, that you're not, I mean, most arable farmers, you know, a chemical salesman, he'll call himself a crop technologist or an agronomist, will come round and give you a program of what sprays to put on your field on what days through the summer. And the farmer is just completely de-skilled, and he's led by this guy who's coming around selling, who is making a percentage on every chemical that he sells. That doesn't sound like a good way to make decisions to me, but that is the way most arable farms, their source of information. And I don't think it's very surprising that they've gone in the direction that they have. So it's much more satisfying, I think, to build up that knowledge yourself. And you know, there's a great pride in being self-sufficient and finding most of the inputs from within the farm rather than, you know, wherever in the world that spray or fertilizer comes from.
I always think about, you know, cooking, which is quite immediate, and, you know, if I want to change something, you know, then it takes me 5 minutes. But if you want to try something new or change something and see the results, for you it's a year and probably a year's salary.
Yeah, it is. The years go by quite quickly.
No, I bet they do, but I'm sure that you've had some...
I suppose I'm just really glad that I'm not growing fruit or trees or something, because then, you know, you're talking, you know, lifetimes. Well, in fact, we are growing nuts and fruit now, and it's a much more, you know, you're your mistakes are going to be much more expensive and much longer lasting. So, you know, you really do have to do your research then. But so I know I was driving around the fields last night, and we've just had this wonderful warm weather, you know, after a very cold spell. And you can see the sweet corn and the squash and pumpkins, all the sun lovers are really taking off. And then certain areas of the field, they're not, you know, and you're always asking, well, what is it that was in that bit of field? What did we do slightly differently before? Was it the way it was cultivated? Was it that the muck spreader was going too fast over that bit and spread it too thin? You know, constantly asking those questions and learning, you know, coming up with theses and checking that against, you know, what's actually working in the field and, you know, and learning. And you know, that's great, isn't it? So, you know, I think a lifetime, but, you know, I hope I'm still learning the day I finally pop my clogs.
You know, that's the dream. I assume if you have a year's crop going bad, or if you, I don't know, overplant or underplant, or, you know, how do you pay the bills? How do you...
I suppose I am in a financially secure position now, and I am able to experiment with some of the more outlandish things that I haven't felt that I'm able to before, because, you know, it was, you know, I was... spent many years quite close. I can't tell you how many times I remortgaged my house. So it is, yeah. It's a journey of discovery. And I used to take it all, when it went wrong, I used to take it very personally. Actually, it was me and the big man up there. And what's he got against me? That's, you know, made my potatoes get blight.
Shouting at the cucumbers.
Yeah, no, you know, I was working, you know, ridiculous hours. You know, and I was probably spent 10 or 15 years of my life suffering from fatigue. And, you know, when you're fatigued, you get quite emotional. And I would, you know, weep in the fields. I can remember collapsing to my knees in a field that had potato blight, and I was trying to spray it with copper sulfate, which has been banned this year, which is probably a good thing. And the sprayer was leaking. The tractor got a flat tire, and I was in the middle of the field. What am I going to do? I just had enough. I collapsed to my knees and wept. Well, there you go. The end world didn't end, and that was 25 years ago. And I've got a better tractor now.
So, just to explain, you know, we do hear a lot about organic vegetables, biodynamic vegetables. They talk to us about GM vegetables or pesticide-free or with pesticide. What should we buy? What's the difference? You know, I know it's a big question.
Oh,
but give us a ballpark.
Well, if I wasn't a vegetable grower myself, the vegetables I would want to grow would probably be grown on a relatively small scale. They would be local, they'd be super fresh, they'd be unpackaged, they'd be grown by a farmer that I knew, that I felt I could trust. I think I'd want them to be certified organic, because I'm afraid too often I've been told to think, oh, it's as good as organic, I just... you know, it's too expensive to get the certification, and you walk around the back and they're using just as many sprays as everyone else. So I'm very cynical of people who say it's as good as organic. But the Demeter thing, biodynamics, this is I feel a bit strange about that. I mean, that was all the work of Rudolf Steiner, who was I'm fundamentally resistant to all dogmatists, and I've read few people more dogmatic than Rudolf Steiner. And it was just a load of ideas that he dreamed up about how, you know, crops should be grown or animals should be looked after. You know, for a man who was a kind of academic, he applied the same to education, actually, you know, with the Steiner schools. And it's just extraordinary how many things he got right. So despite that, I'm reluctant to write it off completely, but it's just...
Does everyone know what's the biodynamic system? It's really... It almost sounds like witchcraft. But it's not. It has some really good things going for it's plant. It's planting moon cycles.
Yeah, and homeopathy would be part of it. The idea that you can, you know, mix something in water and dilute it so many times that there's not even a trace of a molecule in each dose. You know, it's completely, you know, I don't know whether, you know, anti-science as we know it. But actually, it's not anti-science as we know it. I think, so, you know, the fact that there is no one can understand how it may work. A lot of people who I really respect do swear by it, though I do understand that people haven't been able to prove it in replicable experiments. So I think one has to view it with a degree of caution.
Yeah, I mean, if you read about it, you say, this is crazy. But if you go see... a biodynamic farm, or even an allotment grown on biodynamic principles,
I meet some very good growers, you know, very competent, who really know what they're doing, who absolutely swear by it, and I would be reluctant to write it off Completely. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So we know that, say, organic vegetables would be, you know, grown without the use of pesticides.
Yeah, sorry. It's not entirely true to say without pesticides, because there were, I mean, when I last looked it up, we were allowed to use soap, certain formulations of copper against fungal diseases, which I think have mostly been banned this year. We were allowed to use certain natural pyrethrums extracted from chrysanthemum. I think they've pretty much been banned. Soap just kind of suffocates insects. It breaks the surface tension and the water is drawn into their, as it spiracles, whether it's through they breathe through their exoskeleton, and then they drown essentially. So that, and it has, you know, zero mammalian toxicity. So, but we don't even use that anymore, actually, because we did, I think we have occasionally used it in our polytunnels in the spring when we get an outbreak of aphids. But generally, we are working to encourage predators and parasites of the insects to control them. And if you then start spraying with soap, which kills all insects, you are killing the predators and parasites as well. You're into a kind of self-perpetuating cycle. And actually, we have done replicated experiments on the farm with this and sprayed plots with various treatments, including soap and garlic sprays and neem. That was one we were allowed to use, and then a kind of placebo. And 2 weeks later, virtually all the plots had almost all the same number of aphids in it, because in some plots, the soap did kill the pest, but it also killed all the predators and parasites. You know, so the ones that you never kill all of them, you know, even if you kill 95%, the 5% remaining, you know, replicate very quickly. They're on like a 10-day life cycle in the summer. And on that basis, we stopped using soap. We were supplying supermarkets at the time. And we never have done in the field since, and we get fewer and fewer aphids. And, you know, we try to really look after the surrounding hedgerows and so on, so there are lots of flowering plants. So if you start understanding the ecology of lacewings and hoverflies, the adults all feed on flowering plants, so you need to have flowering plants within reasonable proximity of your crop, and then the adults lay their eggs in the crop, and the eggs hatch out, and the juveniles eat the aphids. And it's a beautiful kind of balance that you get to. But it's not as beautiful as the parasitic wasp that goes around and lays a tiny little wasp, and they lay an egg inside each aphid. And 10 days later, they burst out alien style and just be a mummified
Lovely.
They are really beautiful. Honestly, when you go around and you start seeing a few mummified aphids, you know you don't have to worry. Almost however many there are, you know, in 10 days' time, you know, they'll just be, you'll turn a leaf over and it'll be just covered in mummified aphids.
The joys of the farmer. But just to clarify, the vegetables that I would buy non-organic, how did they get to the supermarket? What did they go through?
Depends on the vegetable. But I mean, a lettuce will have been sprayed every week of its life. So it might be in the fields for 8 weeks, in a greenhouse for 3 weeks. And it will be sprayed with an insecticide every 10 days and probably with a fungicide every 10 days. Some of those insecticides are nerve poisons. It will be sprayed probably with weed killers, some of which are hormone disruptors. You know, so there is... And I've got to tell you the story about, I was walking over a field in Cambridge with this farmer, and he was interested in converting to organic. When I walk around my fields, I'm always nibbling at whatever's there, you know, and I bent down to...
I was pick, as well, actually.
Pick, good, that's what we like. Bent down to pick a leaf of lettuce, and he said, oh, I wouldn't eat that, boy. And, you know, this was what he was growing and selling to be, you know, it was sprayed, you know, yesterday or whatever. And indeed, we went in and had lunch, and they showed me around his garden, and in his garden he had his own vegetable plot. He didn't eat his own stuff he sold at the supermarket, and it was grown virtually organically. Yeah, he wouldn't call it organic, but there was a certain sort of antipathy towards organic farmers. But yeah, your vegetables are sprayed quite a lot. Every one of you will have glyphosate in your urine, I can almost guarantee that, unless you've eaten organic bread, you know, exclusively, and flour. And you know, everyone used to say glyphosate was virtually safe to eat. It's Monsanto is facing, well, Bayer, who bought them now, are facing numerous court cases globally because it's, you know, turning out that it certainly
not
isn't safe.
Yeah.
So, having said that, I mean, you know, and that all sounds incredibly alarmist, you know, we'll probably go out and think you should never eat a vegetable again. I mean, the most important thing is that everyone eats lots of fresh fruit and vegetables, really, whether they're organic or not. And if you can get organic ones, great, but don't stop eating fruit and vegetables because, you know, every bit of science suggests that we should be eating a plant-based diet, and I would hate to be responsible for scaring people off fruit and vegetables because the risks associated with a bad diet are far higher than the risks associated with pesticide contamination.
But I do think that we are, and a lot of what we were talking about here the last couple of months is how separated we are from the process of what we eat and how little we know about it and how disconnected. And I think a lot of the confusion stems from that.
Mm.
And this brings me to another kind of innovation that you brought to the world of farming, which is supplying directly. And this I didn't realize until we were in the farm what a huge deal that was, because it goes straight from the field to people's homes.
Sort of 95% plus of what we sell is delivered directly to the doorstep. And probably about, I think we grow maybe 15% of that ourselves now, maybe 20% including the farm in France that we have. And the rest comes from a cooperative of growers around the farm in Devon, and from growers sometimes abroad, sometimes further afield in the UK. And it comes into the barns either down there in Devon, or we also have a pack house in Peterborough on a farm that we've got there. Yeah, and it's packed and it goes straight out to the
but
doorstep.
Why did you... Because there wasn't an existing business model of
not
sending
really.
Boxes
I,
to
well, I, you know,
home.
I wish
it's
I
actually
could...
quite almost a strange idea. You know, I'm going to... Once a week, I'm going to get some beetroot and...
Yeah, it was a ridiculous idea. I mean, you know, in this, we're going back to, 93, but I think the first people who started box seams, there were two of them, one up in Lancashire, I think, and one in Devon, just down the road from us, and they started in the early 90s or late 80s. And it was a time when, you know, supermarkets were selling more and more SKUs, you know, so up to 20,000, 40,000, 50,000 different. You could go and choice, if you had the money, go into a hypermarket, you could have anything you wanted, and you know, the people, fewer and fewer people were having delivered things delivered, whether it was milk, bread, fish or whatever, it was all dying, and everyone was going to these out-of-town supermarkets where you could get whatever you want. So the idea that we were going to deliver a box of vegetables where you didn't have choice to your door seemed completely contrary to, you know, any self-respecting MBA would tell us that it was a dead loss. Never listen to them. And I took some persuading from this person who lived 15 miles away, that he said, come on, guy, you should try this. We both sold to supermarkets. We both hated it. And he said, you really should try this. In fact, he had so many customers, he said, here, you can have 20 of them or something. And the first time I walked up a garden path and knocked on the door and handed over this box of vegetables and had this rapturous reception from someone who really cared what they tasted like and how they were grown and how fresh they were. And, you know, there was no packaging. And you know, compared to the experience of speaking to a supermarket buyer, I tell you, it didn't take very much to persuade. It just went on 2 or 3 years. It just quietly grew away. And then till I finally had a blowout with the Sainsbury's buyer. And then we decided we were going to concentrate all our resources on developing the veg boxes. And as soon as we put a bit more effort into it, it just kind of took off. And so that was about 2001 by then.
So before that, everything you would grow would go to supermarkets?
It went to some wholesalers in London, a few restaurants. Sometimes they paid their bills, sometimes they didn't. I'm sure you always pay your bills.
We do. No, we do.
Good. Well, the wholesalers were the worst, and then there were and then the supermarkets were. It was just unspeakably unpleasant dealing with them, and a few local shops. So we had many masters, and then we decided.
Tell me a little bit about this part of the supply chain, about your dealing with supermarket buyers, and how does that work? Because it's still how most of us consumer get our vegetables.
Well, you know, a supermarket buyer is rewarded solely on how much margin they can generate from a foot of shelf space, and if they generate more than the guy sitting next to him, they get the next promotion. And how can you get you know, more margin by squeezing your suppliers, and, you know, in just unspeakably unpleasant ways, whether it's kickbacks on the packaging, on the haulage, you know, whether it's agreeing to one price and then halfway into the season saying, no, they're going on promotion, we're going to pay you another price. And of course, no one will stand up to them, because no one will even say anything about it. Actually, even after they've been driven to bankruptcy, most people will not say anything about how they've been supplied by a supermarket, how they've been dealt with by a supermarket, because they know that the next company they want to work with is going to be dealing with, you know, one of four supermarkets, and they won't get a job. I mean, it is, you know, some people say they have got better. I mean, there is a government quango who is supposed to look after their treatment of suppliers, and they may have got marginally better since I've
part of the company. How does that work? You know, if your suppliers are so squeezed.
Well, okay, our final thing was we were growing little gem lettuce for, I'm going to say Sainsbury's, I don't give a damn, I'm always told I shouldn't mention the name, but it was Sainsbury's, and we had agreed that really we needed 18p a lettuce to be able to survive. 15p would just about cover our variable costs, and we wouldn't go bust straight away. And we were about 2 or 3 weeks into the season, and they said, they're going on promotion for 6 weeks, you're going to get paid 9p. And what do you do? I mean, most people would say yes, and I did actually. And we'd have their lovely head of public relations and their organic guy, man called Robert Duxbury. I said, well, you know, I wonder what Robert Duxbury would say about that. And he said, Robert who? That, you know, he didn't even know who the person was that was supposed to be determining their policy and so on. That, you know, that there was such a gulf between the sort of public bullshit that they put out there and the actual reality of how they behave, and it was just, you know, there was just it was absolutely despicable. As a matter of fact, I got to know the person who was subsequently who had been responsible for that, and he was a perfectly nice person actually. He was a bit of a teddy bear, to tell you the truth, but he was working in an environment, in an institution that made him behave like a complete bastard. And you know, and it is, anyway, such is capitalism, I suppose. They'll say that they're just doing, providing what their customers want, they're doing what everyone else does. I plead with anyone who works in those sorts of, where that sort of behaviour is normalised, is to stand up and say, no, this isn't okay.
But how do people farm? You know, how does this system?
Well, they don't. They are virtually everyone that I was has just gone bust since then. You know, there are now about 4 fresh produce companies in the UK. You know, there's G's, there's Langmead's, there's Produce World, and a few others, and they supply all the supermarket stuff. They may be supplied by other growers, but they hold the supermarket account. There are farms in Spain. You know, that's how the vegetables get to the supermarket shelves, and it's not an agriculture that I feel comfortable with. It's not, you know, I mean, food is culture, isn't it? I mean, it's so much important for you, isn't it? And you know, where is the culture on the farm? That's where it starts. It's gone. There is no culture there.
And I mean, just for you guys, just to think, I was thinking about what you said. 18p for a gem lettuce would give you profit. We pay £1. You know,
this was quite a few years ago.
You know, still now in Sainsbury's, it's £3 for 2.
Right.
It's very sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sad.
Yeah, and food is 9 or 10% of GDP, but don't think that 9 or 10% goes to farmers. 0.7% of GDP goes to farmers. You know, the rest of it, I never quite understand that figure, whether it includes eating out or whether it's just what's spent in the supermarket, but the amount that goes to a farmer is, and if you take off what you pay in subsidy to us all, it's down to about 0.5% of GDP goes, how much cheaper can food get?
Yeah.
You know, it's almost irrelevant what the farmer gets paid for it, because it's 20 times more expensive by the time you buy it anyway, you know, so what difference does it make?
But this is why I was so amazed when I went to the farm, because this is when I got it, that it's so much more than organic vegetables. It's just a completely new way of consuming food, a completely new kind of financial model, if you will, that can, you know, which means that the supermarkets are out
well
of
it, it is the fact that we deliver directly. I mean, and also yes, I think it is. It's pretty radical what we do. You know, our suppliers, we have a 7-year contract with them. So if we want to stop buying off them, or if they want to stop selling to us, it would take either of us 7 years to get it. But it lives in a bottom drawer. No one looks at this contract. I mean, it is, the whole relationship is based on, you know, long-term, a trust built over many, many years. And that's particularly the case with our local farmers. But it's also the guys that we deal with in Spain. And I think that in itself is radical. The business is now owned by its employees, so that's pretty radical. And we deliver directly to the door. I mean, that's less radical in the age of, you know, internet retailing. It's becoming more normal. And of course, it's
all
organic.
No, I think it's still very radical because it grows, because there's no retailer in the middle.
Probably the most radical thing of all, though, I think, is that we don't believe the customer's always right. I think that's, you know, which is where it all starts. If you think the customer's always right and they always must have the cheapest little gem lettuce, they must have it, you know, 365 days a year if that's what they want, then that's where it all starts. That's what drives it all. You know, it's having the courage to say no. And actually, I think in all sorts of things that we've done, we have said no. And you know, we have been supported by our customers in that, because actually that's not what a lot of people want. That, I mean, how is that choice? They're all bloody same, aren't they? I mean, it may seem very, you know, middle class and exclusive and so on, but there are, you know, it is really important to support the alternatives, be it a farmer's market or a box scheme. And there are, you know, lots of other box schemes in London, some of them more radical than us actually. Then you do have a choice. You might not always get exactly what that recipe tells you, you know, you should be putting in your tagine that night, or but you know, are you willing to make those sacrifices, you know, to step out of your comfort zone to really embrace a different choice? And you know, I really think that we need to, actually, just doing what everyone else does and whatever's easy.
I have to ask you can, just a simple, are you optimistic?
The climate rebellion and the Greta Thunberg stuff has given me some hope, actually. There are lots of good things going on. That I mean, farming actually is really changing. you know, I went to a conference in the spring down in Cornwall with this radical Australian talking about, you know, regenerative agriculture. He was a soil scientist. And I went there and expected to see the normal organic people. And there were like 200 farmers in the room who were just lapping it up, you know, about, you know, these mycorrhizal fungi and invertebrates in the soil that they had to look after and the damage that glyphosate was doing them to them, so on. Anyway, I think there is a real appetite for change. I think this 60 years we've had of agriculture being led by the agrochemical industry, I do think is coming to an end, or at least being challenged. And so there is some hope in that. My despair really is really with the sort of unbridled capitalism and the you know, what comes if you worship the marketplace as you do when you go into church, really, which is, you know, we need something pretty damn radical for people to say, no, I'm just really not happy for that. We really need a change. Let's hope it might be Caroline Lucas and some sort of central alliance of liberal Greens, I think, I see as the only hope. Yeah.
Good, I think we all got the rant that we came for. You became quite famous for them, and actually there's a book as well, a little book of rants, which is actually a really, really good read.
Short rants.
Really good read. I want you to help me say a big, big thank you to Guy Singh Watson for being with us tonight. It's been so interesting. We could have stayed here for hours and hours, you know, ranting and putting the world to right. Big round of applause, please.
This is the last episode of this series in which we've chatted to makers, growers and producers from E5 Bakehouse to Bermondsey Street Bees. This has been a really fascinating series for us, and actually so, so positive to find out more of the wonderful things small producers are doing. If you enjoyed this, please rate us and leave a review. It helps other people find us. And if you want to let us know what you think or what you want to listen, drop us a line on Twitter or on Instagram. Coming up next, we have a very special mini-series coming up from the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is all about their exhibition, Food Bigger Than the Plate. It's a fascinating exhibition. We've loved so much of the exhibits there. And we're going to talk with some of the artists and makers that are exhibiting. We hope to see you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to our latest episode. If you'd like to join one of the next talks, please follow us on social media at Honey & Co. or go on our website, honeyandco.co.uk. With a huge thanks to Hester Kant for producing.
A special thanks to our own Louisa Cornford for her wonderful research.
And the music is by the lovely Alice Russell. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.